Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Dozens are killed as a dam burst in Kenya following devastating rains.
I want to advise the members of public within these areas that they should keep off from the floods. They should move to higher grounds whereby they cannot be swept by water, because it's like there is a heavy rain is coming and it might not be good.
The Nigerian community in South Africa calls for an investigation into what it calls the discriminate arrest of its members. Good governance activists say South Africa's corruption whistleblowers should be protected. A Ugandan parliamentarian defends the government's human rights record. Vote counting continued overnight in Togo following Monday's election for parliament and regional representatives.
The African Union, ECOWAS, the Francophonie have deployed international observers, and also you have a lot of national civil society who deployed also observers.
And a committee to protect journalists calls for an unconditional release of an Ethiopian reporter. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. More than 40 people have died in southwestern Kenya after a dam burst on Sunday night following heavy rains, which spawned devastating flooding across the country. Earlier, several people went missing after their boat capsized in a river in eastern Kenya. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenyan rescue teams are searching for survivors swept away by floods Sunday night in the Mahimahiu area of Nakuru County. Heavy rainfall caused a dam to burst its banks, adding to the casualties from the flash flooding. John Karungu lives near the dam. He explains what happened to his neighbors when water entered their homes. He says the dam broke around 2:30 in the morning. We heard a loud noise from the riverside, and we fled from the rising water. He says people on the downstream side pleaded for help as the rushing water engulfed their homes. We managed to rescue several children who were swept on the sides, he says, and pulled others from the waters. But sadly, some were swept away. According to residents, at least 16 homes were swept away in the area. Kenyan Transport Minister Kipchumba Murkomen and Nakuru County Governor Susan Kihika visited the flood zone to assess the damage and mobilize authorities and agencies for rescue operations and aid distribution to the victims. Naivasha Police Commander Stephen Kirui told VOA they have recovered dozens of bodies, and some of the survivors were admitted to hospitals in the area.
We have retrieved so far, about 45 bodies. We have not identified the sex and, of course, adults and children. Almost about 3 villages have been swept. We find out that a large number of 110 persons have been admitted in several hospitals within Naivasha sub-county.
Kirui said it was still raining in the area. Last week, the Kenya Red Cross warned of more rains, called on Kenyans to brace for more flooding, and urged the population to take precautions. Kirui says they have managed to clear the roads, but the flooding threat persists.
The situation now is coming to a normalcy where the roads are now passable. We are trying to remove the trees which has already barricaded the roads, and now I think the roads are movable. I want to advise the members of public within these areas that they should keep off from the floods. They should move to higher grounds whereby they cannot be swept by water, because it's like there is a heavy rain which is coming and it might not be good.
Kenyan media reports that flooding has claimed the lives of more than 100 people since the rainy season began in mid-March. The death toll is expected to rise after a boat capsized in the Tana River in eastern Kenya over the weekend. The Kenyan Red Cross said it rescued 23 people from the boat, but more than a dozen were still missing. The flooding has prompted the Kenyan government to delay the reopening of schools until next week. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
Vote counting continued in Togo overnight following Monday's election for members of parliament and regional representatives. Analysts say the outcome of the vote would likely be a referendum on a controversial constitutional reform adopted this month, which allows the parliament to elect the president as opposed to a direct election by voters. President Paul Nasimwe's ruling Union for the Republic Party already has a majority of seats in parliament, which makes it likely he will remain in power for an unforeseeable period. Gilbo Bawara is the Togolese Minister for Civil Service, Labor and Social Dialogue. He tells me that voting went on smoothly on Monday under the watchful eye of local and international observers.
You know that the government is paying for the political party and the candidate to deploy their delegates in the voting stations. So I think there's no excuse for anyone not to be present or to have a witness and a delegate so that everything will be completely transparent and credible.
Did you allow for international observers to come and observe the election, or African observers from other countries?
Of course. The African Union, ECOWAS, the Francophonie have deployed international observers, and also you have a lot of national civil society who deployed also observers. You have international and national observers. In addition to the delegate of the candidate and the parties to the voting and polling stations.
Help our listeners to understand. So after this election, whoever wins the majority of parliamentary seats will choose the next president. Is that what the constitution says?
No. The new president will be chosen by the Senate and the National Assembly together. It means the members of the Senate and the members of the National Assembly, all together they will elect the president of the republic. And the party or the coalition of a political party that will have the majority in the National Assembly will choose the president of the council. The president of the council will also be the head of the government.
Gilbert, what I see is that some people are saying the way your government is going about this whole constitutional reform is an attempt for President Fona Sibwe to avoid a presidential election, which he might lose. That's the concern.
But the Togolese who went to vote today, it would have been the same Togolese who would have gone to vote for presidential election. They completely know that today, if they vote for a majority to union party, it means they are expressing their support and their trust to President Fona. But if they don't like President Fona, if they don't like Unity Party, so we will see it in the results. I don't see how the same people going to vote today, we trust them when they are voting today and will not trust them when they would have to vote in 2025. No, we did it because we think we needed to make economy to reduce the number of elections and make sure that political parties are really installed and present around the country and not only in some part of the country.
When do you think the results will be out?
Because everything is completely transparent, tonight we will have some indications already.
Gilbo Bawara is the Togolese Minister for Civil Servants, Labor and Social Dialogue. He is also a prominent member of the ruling Union for the Republic. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lome. A Ugandan parliamentarian from the Governing National Resistance Movement, NRM, says the government has made significant progress in the protection of human rights and freedoms despite criticism from the opposition. Felix Odupa Ongwet says that tourism is suffering due to negative reports that opposition leaders sent overseas. His remarks follow a recent report by the U.S. State Department on human rights practices in Uganda. It highlighted challenges or weaknesses the country faces, including lack of judicial independence. But parliamentary Felix Odupa tells viewers Peter Clotty that nothing prevents opposition leaders from putting forward a motion in the legislature to ensure the protection of human rights in Uganda.
This is not news to us as the members of the ruling party. It has always been the opposition cry after every cycle of the election. For instance, we are now 1 year close to the next general election. That's when you start hearing the stories of abuse of human rights because they want to attract international body sympathy. They want international body to Uganda as the most violator of human rights, abused human rights and dignity. And that is what they are always trading. the country for, so that they can be getting those assistance from the international community. So it has been politics.
Are you saying that there has been improved the respect of human rights on the ground? Because some civil society groups are saying that they have seen some improvement. Others are saying not so much, and that the abuse of citizens keeps going on without the NRM saying a word, particularly the NRM in parliament, including you.
Uganda, it's a signatory to you to the international human rights body. We are part of that body, and we protect the human rights and dignity. However, there are always challenges, and Uganda is not exceptional to those challenges.
The latest State Department human rights report, the opposition is saying it's a clear indication that what you just said, that there has been an improvement, is not so, and that the judiciary lacks independence, and that even when issues are brought to the NRM in parliament, the NRM folks like you keep quiet.
The opposition has been going to court of law. They have won several cases in court of law. They have lost several cases. NRM has been to court. They have won. They have lost. But when they have lost the case in court, that's when they say that, no, the court is not working independently. The court is biased against the opposition. Why is it whenever they have a pressing matter, they run to the court that they said it is biased against them? If the judiciary is not independent, people like Dr. Kizza Besigye, people like Bobby Wine and so on, would have not been released from prison, would have not got court bail.
Felix Adupa Ongwech is a Ugandan member of parliament from the Governing National Resistance Movement. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 30th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The Nigerian community in South Africa is calling for investigation into what it calls the indiscriminate arrest of its members, some of whom allegedly died during routine police raids at their homes and businesses. Doris Ikiri Solarin is the president of the Nigerian Union of South Africa. She told VOA's Chinedu Ofor that a recent meeting with a regional police chief was met to de-escalate growing tension among the immigrant community and law enforcement agencies.
We traveled all the way from Gauteng to the northern province, Kimberley specifically, in the company of the acting High Commissioner, Ambassador Tope Ajayi, and also representative of the consulate, as well as the leaders of the Nigerian community. So it was a very big meeting, a cluster meeting with the regional police commander of the Northern Cape province, as well as the entire team. We had robust discussions regarding a police brutality and led to the escalation and the arrest of the 8 nationals that were accused by the SAPN.
South African police authorities say they are doing all they can to reduce crime and that this is not about a particular country. But some of your members are saying Nigerians are unfairly targeted. Do you have evidence to prove this?
There are pictures, there are videos, and there are footages in some cases. And even before commencing the attacks, some of those police officers move in the company of ambulance, which means this is a premeditated attempt to inflict injuries on members of the public that are being attacked. So I don't think it's proper, and it's a criminal act to actually assault a suspect. Many of these people are in the hospitals, so there are files opened, injuries that are sustained, ongoing treatments, while others are in custody. So these are evidences to prove that the police brutality is actually ongoing.
Have you contacted the Nigerian embassy or Nigerian officials, and what has been their reaction?
Before we even go ahead, we contact the consulate and the High Commission. In fact, this meeting was being orchestrated by the acting High Commissioner, who was on the trip with us. We went there and we arrived also. He was able to elaborate on most of these instances that I've just mentioned here. But with what is going on currently, there is a serious concern about this increased police brutality, because on arrival from the meeting with the regional commander of police of the Northern Cape, another report reaching us is that another Nigerian was attacked in his residence. He was raided by South African police and murdered in his residence at Spring.
That was Doris Ikiri Solarin, the president of Nigerian Union of South Africa, speaking from Johannesburg with viewers Chinedu Ofowo. Martha Ngoye was the legal executive at the South African state-owned passenger rail agency, which she blew the whistle on unlawful government contracts worth millions. But instead of being honored as a corruption buster, she was fired by her employer and faced a lengthy and costly legal battle to get her job back. Martha's experience highlights the challenges faced by whistleblowers in South Africa. Isan Hefiji has this report.
You know, psychologically as well, it's taken a huge toll psychologically, not only on me, on my daughter as well, and the family as well. But I've been fortunate because I've had a support structure.
While Martha continues the legal fight in court to get her job back, she has joined a newly formed civil society organization called the Whistleblower House, which offers support and advice to whistleblowers in South Africa. At times, whistleblowers have paid the ultimate price in the fight against corruption. In 2021, government employee Babita Diokeran was murdered outside her home after it emerged she had uncovered corruption in the provincial health department. Journalist Jeff Weeks spent months investigating the circumstances that led to her murder.
She was returning home after dropping her daughter at school, and when she slowed to move her car into her driveway, another vehicle pulled up alongside her and three men pumped her car full of bullets, and she was shot 12 times. What we didn't know then, and we only found out subsequently several months later, was that in the weeks before she was killed, she had stumbled across anomalous payment patterns and had reported them to her superiors. She'd wanted an urgent investigation and a stop to the payments. And even just days before she was killed, she sent a message to her boss saying, "These guys might be onto us if we stop their money and our lives might be in danger." And that message turned out to be fairly prescient because she was killed within less than a week.
Cynthia Stumple is another whistleblower who exposed corruption in South Africa's state-owned airlines. She says whistleblowers are a fundamental component in the fight against corruption.
My own view is that whistleblowers are truly important in fighting corruption because they are the ones who highlight and expose and speak out about either fraud happening in their workplace, corruption, and so they are that first point of call, and we really need to take them seriously rather than victimize them.
The South African government has acknowledged the importance of protecting whistleblowers. It has committed to reviewing the current laws on whistleblowers as part of its national anti-corruption strategy. Dr. Uglesha Radulovic from the University of Johannesburg researches the plight of whistleblowers. He says that changes are required to further strengthen the legislation surrounding the protection of whistleblowers.
So I think what would be crucial would be to revise the legislation to broaden the protection for whistleblowers and to penalize those that are retaliating against whistleblowers. And the second thing that would be crucial would be to create a stronger relationship between the state and civil society, and an independent state institution could provide the resolution there.
Whistleblowers remain an invaluable resource in the fight against corruption and the protection of democracy. But the whistleblowers we have spoken to believe that they are not getting the support and protection that they so desperately need. Ihsan Hefiji, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
This Friday, May 3rd, is World Press Freedom Day, and the Committee to Protect Journalists, the CPJ, says dozens of journalists are being detained around the world. In Ethiopia, journalist Muhyiddin Mohammed Abdullahi, who was arrested almost a month ago, faces up to 5 years in prison for publishing reports and commentary on his Facebook page. Muntoki Momo is the Sub-Saharan African director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She tells Viewers Carol Van Dam that the CPJ is calling for Abdullahi's unconditional release.
Muhyiddin is a journalist who was arrested in Ethiopia's Somali region earlier this year, and he was accused of inciting violence. Now, the interesting thing about his case is that he was actually granted bail several weeks ago. Now, the last time I checked on this was that he remained detained despite having been granted bail. And that, for us, is symptomatic of a broader pattern that we see in Ethiopia beyond the Somali region, where, one, journalists are arrested, they're detained sometimes without being produced in court immediately, and even when they're produced in court, they're not charged immediately. They're accused of vague offenses, usually anti-state offenses, offenses that have to do with speech, accused of inciting violence or committing offenses against the constitution. And then they're not charged and they remain in this limbo, this pre-charge situation, which can drag on for weeks, sometimes for months. And then when the courts finally have enough and say, you know what, we're giving them bail, the police don't always immediately comply with bail orders. They try to maneuver around that. They might, you know, introduce new charges, move someone from one jurisdiction to another, or in some cases just, you know, plain ignore the court orders. It is an example of a broader pattern that we've seen in Ethiopia, where at least 8 other journalists are detained, most of them in Addis Ababa, and most of them have been detained for months and months. Some of them have been detained for a year already.
He published and did commentary, right? Or, you know, what is his background in journalism?
Previously, he worked for a media outlet called Kalsan. But in the months before his arrest, Muhyiddin was actually publishing his content on Facebook. He had a Facebook page, which he was calling Muhyiddin Show. It's a mix of news items, local news items, and commentary. You know, the traditional, quote-unquote, traditional media might not penetrate to the most far-flung areas. You do find a lot of journalists using social media, whether that's on Facebook, whether that's on YouTube, whether that's on X, to actually publish commentary and to publish news about their local communities. And increasingly then what you see is that the repression follows online, that it's no longer just, oh, we're going to shut down broadcasting outlets or this newspaper, but, you know, authorities really being concerned about what people are posting on Facebook or on Twitter, on YouTube, and going after that.
That was Muntoki Momo, Sub-Saharan Africa Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She was speaking from Nairobi with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations on Monday warned of an impending large-scale massacre in the Sudanese city of El Fasher, a humanitarian hub in the Darfur region. The French news agency AFP quotes Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield as saying there are already credible reports that the RSF and its allied militias have razed multiple villages west of El Fasher, and as we speak, the RSF is planning an imminent attack on El Fasher, which she said would be a disaster on top of a disaster. The city had until recently been relatively unaffected by fighting between the Sudanese Armed Forces, the SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, but bombardment and clashes have been reported both there and in surrounding villages since mid-April. And that's it for this Tuesday, April 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.